hockey jersey. There was a puddle of blood underneath his side and a gunshot wound through his forehead. Patrick reached out for a baseball cap that had fallen a few feet away, with the words Sterling Hockey embroidered across it. He turned the brim around in his hands, an imperfect circle. The girl lying next to him was face down, blood spreading from beneath her temple. She was barefoot, and on her toenails was bright pink polish, just like the stuff Tara had put on Patrick. It made his heart catch. This girl, just like his goddaughter and her brother and a million other kids in this country, had gotten up today and gone to school, never imagining she would be in danger. She trusted all the grown-ups and teachers and principals to keep her safe. It was why these schools, post-9/11, had teachers wearing ID all the time and doors locked during the day. The enemy was always supposed to be an outsider, not the kid who was sitting right next to you. Suddenly, the girl shifted.
Help me?
Patrick knelt beside her.
I'm here, he said, his touch gentle as he assessed her condition. Everything's all right.
He turned her enough to see that the blood was coming from a cut on her scalp, not a gunshot wound, as he'd assumed. He ran his hands over her limbs. He kept murmuring to her, words that didn't always make sense, but that let her know that she wasn't alone anymore.
What's your name, sweetheart?
Josie.
The girl started to thrash, trying to sit up. Patrick put the bulk of his body strategically between her and the boys. She'd be in shock already. He didn't need her to go over the edge. She touched her hand to her forehead, and when it came away oily with blood, she panicked.
What happened?
He should have stayed there and waited for the medics to come get her. He should have radioed for help. But should hardly seem to apply anymore, and so Patrick lifted Josie into his arms. He carried her out of the locker room, where she'd nearly been killed, hurried down the stairs, and pushed through the front door of the school, as if he might be able to save them both.
Seventeen years before. There were 14 people sitting in front of Lacey, if you counted the fact that each of the 7 women attending this prenatal class was pregnant. Some of them had come equipped with notebooks and pens, and had spent the past hour and a half writing down recommended dosages of folic acid, the names of teratogens, and suggested diets for a mother-to-be. 2 had turned green in the middle of the discussion of a normal birth and had rushed to the bathroom with morning sickness, which, of course, stretched as long as the whole day and was like saying summertime when you really meant all 4 seasons of the year. She was tired. Only a week back into work after her own maternity leave, it seemed patently unfair that if she wasn't up all night with her own baby, she had to be awake delivering someone else's. Her breasts ached, an uncomfortable reminder that she had to go pump again, so that she'd have milk to leave the sitter tomorrow for Peter. And yet, she loved her job too much to give it up entirely. She'd had the grades to get into medical school and had considered being an OBGYN, until she realized that she had a profound inability to sit bedside by a patient and not feel her pain. Doctors put a wall up between themselves and their patients. Nurses broke it down. She switched into a program that would certify her as a nurse midwife, that encouraged her to tap into the emotional health of a mother-to-be instead of just her symptomology. Maybe it made some of the doctors at the hospital consider her a flake, but Lacey truly believed that when you asked a patient, "How do you feel?" what was wrong wasn't nearly as important as what was right. She reached past the plastic model of the growing fetus and lifted a best-selling pregnancy guidebook into the air.
How many of you have seen this book before?
7 hands lifted.
Okay. Do not buy this book. Do not read this book. If it's already at your house, throw it out.
This book will convince you that you are going to bleed out, have seizures, drop dead, or any of 100 other things that don't happen with normal pregnancies. Believe me, the range of normal is much wider than anything these authors will tell you. She glanced in the back, where a woman was holding her side. Cramping? Lacey thought. Ectopic pregnancy? The woman was dressed in a black suit, her hair pulled back into a neat, low ponytail. Lacey watched her pinch her waist once again, this time pulling off a small beeper attached to her skirt. She got to her feet.
I'm sorry. I have to go.
Can it wait a few minutes? Lacey asked. We're just about to go on a tour of the birthing pavilion. The woman handed her the paperwork she'd been asked to fill out during this visit.
I have something more pressing to deal with, she said, and she hurried off.
Well, Lacey said, maybe this is a good time for a bathroom break. As the six remaining women filed out of the room, she glanced down at the forms in her hand.
Alexandra Cormier, she read, and she thought, I'm going to have to watch this one.
The last time Alex had defended Loomis Bronchetti, he had broken into 3 homes and stolen electronics equipment, which he then tried to fence on the streets of Enfield, New Hampshire. Although Loomis was enterprising enough to dream up this scheme, he failed to realize that in a town as small as Enfield, hot stereo equipment might raise a red flag. Apparently, Loomis had escalated his criminal resume last night when he and 2 friends decided to go after a drug dealer who didn't bring them enough pot. They got high, hogtied the guy, and threw him in the trunk. Loomis whacked the dealer over the head with a baseball bat, cracking his skull and sending him into convulsions. When he started choking on his own blood, Loomis turned him over so that he could breathe.
I can't believe they're charging me with assault, Loomis told Alex through the bars of the holding cell. I saved the guy's life.
Well, Alex said, we might have been able to use that if you hadn't been the one who inflicted the injury in the first place.
You gotta plead me out for less than a year. I don't want to get sent down to the prison in Concord.
You could have been charged with attempted murder, you know. Loomis scowled.
I was doing the cops a favor, getting a lowlife like that off the streets.
The same, Alex knew, could be said for Loomis Bronchetti, if he was convicted and sent to the state prison. But her job was not about judging Loomis. It was about working hard, in spite of her personal opinions about a client. It was about showing one face to Loomis and knowing she had another one masked away. It was about not letting her feelings interfere with her ability to get Loomis Bronchetti acquitted.
Let me see what I can do, she said.
Lacey understood that all infants were different, tiny little creatures with their own quirks and habits and peeves and desires. But somehow, she'd expected that this second foray into motherhood would produce a child like her first, Joey. A golden boy who would make passers-by turn their heads, stop her as she pushed the stroller to tell her what a beautiful child she had. Peter was just as beautiful, but he was definitely a more challenging baby. He'd cry, colicky, and have to be soothed by putting his car seat on the vibrating clothes dryer. He'd be nursing and suddenly arch away from her. It was 2 in the morning, and Lacey was trying to get Peter to settle back to sleep. Unlike Joey, who fell into slumber like taking a giant step off a cliff, Peter fought it every step of the way. She patted his back and rubbed small circles between his tiny shoulder blades as he hiccuped and wailed. Frankly, she felt like doing that too. For the past 2 hours, she'd watched the same infomercial on Ginsu knives. She had counted the ticking stripes on the elephantine arm of the sofa until they blurred. She was so exhausted that everything ached.
What's the matter, little man? She sighed. What can I do to make you happy? Happiness was relative, according to her husband. Although most people laughed when Lacey told them her husband's job involved putting a price on joy, it was simply what economists did, find value for the intangibles in life. Lewis's colleagues at Sterling College had presented papers on the relative push an education could provide, or universal health care, or job satisfaction. Lewis's discipline was no less important, if unorthodox. It made him a popular guest on NPR, on Larry King, at corporate seminars. Somehow, number crunching seemed sexier when you began talking about the dollar amount a belly laugh was worth, or a dumb blonde joke, for that matter. Regular sex, for example, was equivalent, happiness-wise, to getting a $50,000 raise. However, getting a $50,000 raise wouldn't be nearly as exciting if everyone else was getting a $50,000 raise, too. By the same token, what made you happy once might not make you happy now. 5 years ago, Lacey would have given anything for a dozen roses brought home by her husband. Now, if he offered her the chance to take a 10-minute nap, she would fall to the ground in paroxysms of delight. Statistics aside, Lewis would go down in history as being the economist who'd conceived a mathematical formula for happiness. R over E, or reality divided by expectations. There were two ways to be happy. Improve your reality, or lower your expectations. Once, at a neighborhood dinner party, Lacey had asked him what happened if you had no expectations. You couldn't divide by zero. Did that mean if you just let yourself roll with all of life's punches, you could never be happy? In the car later that night, Lewis had accused her of trying to make him look bad. Lacey didn't like to let herself consider whether Lewis and their family were truly happy. You'd think the man who designed the formula would have happiness figured out, but somehow it didn't work that way. Sometimes she'd recall that old adage, "The shoemaker's sons go barefoot," and she'd wonder, what about the children of the man who knows the value of happiness? These days, when Lewis was late at the office, working on another publication deadline, and Lacey was so exhausted she could fall asleep standing up in the hospital elevator, she tried to convince herself it was simply a phase they were stuck in, a baby boot camp that would surely transform one day into contentment and satisfaction and togetherness and all the other parameters Lewis plotted on his computer programs. After all, she had a husband who loved her, and two healthy boys, and a fulfilling career. Wasn't getting what you wanted all along the very definition of being happy? She realized that, miracle of miracles, Peter had fallen asleep on her shoulder, the sweet peach of his cheek pressed against her bare skin. Tiptoeing up the stairs, she gently settled him into his crib and then glanced across the room at the bed where Joey lay. The moon fawned over him like a disciple. She wondered what Peter would be like when he was Joey's age. She wondered if you could get that lucky twice. Alex Cormier was younger than Lacey had thought, 24, but she carried herself with enough confidence to make people think she was a decade older. "So," Lacey said, introducing herself, "how did that pressing matter turn out?" Alex blinked at her, then remembered, the birthing pavilion tour she had slipped away from a week ago. "It was plea bargained." "You're a lawyer, then?" Lacey said, glancing up from her notes. "A public defender." Alex's chin came up a notch, as if she was ready for Lacey to make a deprecating comment about her affiliation with the bad guys. "That must be awfully demanding work," Lacey said. "Does your office know you're pregnant?" Alex shook her head. "It's not an issue," she said flatly. "I won't be taking a maternity leave." "You might change your mind, as I'm not keeping this baby," Alex announced. Lacey sat back in her chair. "All right." It wasn't her place to judge a mother for the decision to give up a child. We can talk about different options then, Lacey said. At 11 weeks, Alex could still terminate the pregnancy if she wished.
I was going to have an abortion, Alex said, as if she had read Lacey's mind, but I missed my appointment. She glanced up. Twice.
Lacey knew you could be solidly pro-choice, but unwilling or unable to make that decision for yourself. That's exactly where the choice part kicked in.
Well then, she said, I can give you information about adoption, if you haven't already contacted any agencies yourself.
She reached into a drawer and pulled out folders. Adoption agencies affiliated with a variety of religions, attorneys who specialized in private adoptions. Alex took the pamphlets and held them like a hand of playing cards.
For now, though, we can just focus on you and how you're doing.
I'm great, Alex answered smoothly. I'm not sick. I'm not tired.
She looked at her watch. I am, however, going to be late for an appointment.
Lacey could tell that Alex was a coper, someone who was used to being in control in all facets of her life.
It's okay to slow down when you're pregnant. Your body might need that.
I know how to take care of myself.
What about letting someone else do it once in a while?
A shadow of irritation crossed over Alex's face.
Look, I don't need a therapy session, honestly. I appreciate the concern, but does your partner support your decision to give the baby up? Lacey asked.
Alex turned her face away for a moment. Before Lacey could find the right words to draw her back, however, Alex did it herself.
There is no partner, she said coolly.
The last time Alex's body had taken over, had done what her mind told her not to do, she had conceived this baby. It had started innocently enough. Logan Rourke, her trial advocacy professor, calling her into his office to tell her that she commanded the courtroom with competence. Logan saying that no juror would be able to take his eyes off her, and that neither could he. Alex had thought Logan was Clarence Darrow and F. Lee Bailey and God rolled up into one. Prestige and power could make a man so attractive it took one's breath away. It turned Logan into what she'd been looking for her whole life. She believed him when he told her he hadn't seen a student with as quick a mind as Alex in his 10 years of teaching. She believed him when he told her that his marriage was over in all but name. And she believed him the night he drove her home from the campus, framed her face between his hands, and told her she was the reason he got up in the morning. Law was a study of detail and fact, not emotion. Alex's cardinal mistake had been forgetting this when she became involved with Logan. She found herself postponing plans, waiting for his call, which sometimes came and sometimes didn't. She pretended that she didn't see him flirting with the first-year law students who looked at him the way she used to. And when she got pregnant, she convinced herself that they were meant to spend the rest of their lives together. Logan had told her to get rid of it. She'd scheduled an abortion, only to forget to write the date and time on her calendar. She rescheduled, but realized too late that her appointment conflicted with a final exam. After that, she'd gone to Logan.
It's a sign, she'd said.
Maybe, he told her, but it doesn't mean what you're thinking. Be reasonable, Logan had said. A single mother will never make it as a trial attorney. She'd have to choose between her career and this baby. What he really meant was that she'd have to choose between having the baby and having him. The woman looked familiar from behind, in that way that people sometimes do when you see them out of context, your grocery clerk standing in line at the bank, your postman sitting across the aisle of the movie theater. Alex stared for another second, and then realized it was the infant throwing her off. She strode across the hallway of the courthouse toward the town clerk, where Lacey Houghton stood paying a parking ticket.
Need a lawyer?
Alex asked. Lacey looked up, the baby carrier balanced in the crook of her arm.
It took a moment to place the face. She hadn't seen Alex since her initial visit nearly a month ago.
"Oh, hello," she said, smiling.
"What brings you to my neck of the woods?"
"Oh, I'm posting bail for my ex."
Lacey waited for Alex's eyes to widen and then laughed.
"Just kidding. I got a parking ticket."
Alex found herself staring down at the face of Lacey's son. He wore a blue cap that tied underneath his chin, and his cheeks spilled over the edges of the fleece. He had a runny nose, and when he noticed Alex looking at him, he offered her a cavernous smile.
"Would you like to grab a cup of coffee?" Lacey said.
She slapped $10 down on top of her parking ticket and fed it through the open mouth of the payment window, then hefted the baby bucket a little higher into the crook of her arm and walked out of the court building to a Dunkin' Donuts across the street. Lacey stopped to give a $10 bill to a bum sitting outside the courthouse, and Alex rolled her eyes. She'd actually seen this particular fellow heading over to the closest bar yesterday when she left work. In the coffee shop, Alex watched Lacey effortlessly unpeel layers of clothing from her baby and lift him out of his seat onto her lap. As she talked, she draped a blanket over her shoulder and started to nurse Peter.
"Is it hard?" Alex blurted out.
"Nursing?"
"Not just that," Alex said. "Everything."
"It's definitely an acquired skill." Lacey lifted the baby onto her shoulder. His booted feet kicked against her chest as if he was already trying to put distance between them.
"Compared to your day job, motherhood is probably a piece of cake."
It made Alex think, immediately, of Logan Rourke, who had laughed at her when she said she was taking a job with the public defender's office.
"You won't last a week," he'd told her. "You're too soft for that."
She sometimes wondered if she was a good public defender because of skill or because she had been so determined to show Logan that he was wrong. In any case, Alex had cultivated a persona on the job, one that was there to give offenders an equal voice in the legal system without letting clients get under her skin. She'd already made that mistake with Logan.
"Did you get a chance to contact any of the adoption agencies?" Lacey asked.
Alex hadn't even taken the pamphlets she'd been given. For all she knew, they were still sitting on the counter of the examination room.
"I put in a few calls," Alex lied.
She had it on her to-do list at work. It was just that something else always got in the way.
"Can I ask you a personal question?" Lacey said,
and Alex nodded slowly. She didn't like personal questions.
"What made you decide to give the baby up?"
Had she ever really made that decision? Or had it been made for her?
"This isn't a good time," Alex said.
Lacey laughed. "I don't know if it's ever a good time to have a baby. Your life certainly gets turned upside down."
Alex stared at her.
"I like my life right side up." Lacey fussed with her baby's shirt for a moment.
"In a way, what you and I do isn't really all that different."
"The recidivism rate is probably about the same," Alex said.
"No, I meant that we both see people when they're at their most raw. That's what I love about midwifery. You see how strong someone is in the face of a really painful situation."
She glanced up at Alex.
"Isn't it amazing how, when you strip away everything, people are so much alike?"
Alex thought of the defendants that had paraded through her professional life. They all blurred together in her mind. But was that because, as Lacey said, we were all similar? Or was it because Alex had become an expert at not looking too closely? She watched Lacey settle the baby on her knee. His hands smacked the table, and he made little gurgling noises. Suddenly, Lacey stood up, thrusting the baby toward Alex so that she had to hold him or risk having him tumble onto the floor.
"Here, hang on to Peter. I just have to run into the bathroom."
Alex panicked.
"Wait," she thought. "I don't know what I'm doing."
The baby's legs kicked like a cartoon character who'd run off a cliff. Awkwardly, Alex sat him down on her lap. He was heavier than she would have imagined, and his skin felt like damp velvet.
"Peter," she said formally, "I'm Alex."
The baby reached for her coffee cup, and she lurched forward to push it out of reach. Peter's face pinched tight as a lime, and he started to cry. The screams were shattering, decibel-rich, cataclysmic.
"Stop,"
Alex begged, as people around her started to stare. She stood up, patting Peter's back the way Lacey had, wishing he would run out of steam, or contract laryngitis, or just simply have mercy on her utter inexperience. Alex, who always had the perfect witty comeback, who could be thrown into a hellish legal situation and land on her feet every time without even breaking a sweat, found herself completely at a loss. She sat down and held Peter beneath his armpits. By now, he'd turned tomato red, his skin so angry and dark that his soft fuzz of hair glowed like platinum.
"Listen," she said, "I may not be what you want right now, but I'm all you've got."
On a final hiccup, the baby quieted. He stared into Alex's eyes as if he was trying to place her. Relieved, Alex settled him into the sling of her arm and sat a little taller. She glanced down at the top of the baby's head, at the translucent pulse beneath his fontanelle. When she relaxed her grip on the baby, he relaxed too. Was it that easy? Alex traced her finger over the soft spot on Peter's head. She knew the biology behind it. The plates of the skull shifted enough to make giving birth easier. They fused together by the time the baby was a toddler. It was a vulnerability we were all born with, one that literally grew into an adult's hard-headedness.
"Sorry," Lacey said, breezing back to the table. "Thanks for that."
Alex thrust the baby out toward her as if she were being burned. The patient had been transferred from a 30-hour home birth. A firm believer in natural medicine, she'd limited prenatal care, no amnio, no sonograms, and yet newborns had a way of getting what they wanted and needed when it came time to arrive in the world. Lacey laid her hands on the woman's trembling belly like a faith healer. 6 pounds, she thought. Bottom up here, head down there. A doctor poked his head through the door.
"How's it going in here?"
"Tell the intensive care nursery we're at 35 weeks, she said, "but everything seems to be fine."
As the doctor backed away, she settled herself between the woman's legs.
"I know this has been going on for what seems like forever," she said, "but if you can work with me for just one more hour, you'll have this baby."
As she directed the woman's husband to get behind his wife, holding her upright as she began to push, Lacey felt her pager vibrate at the waistline of her sea-blue scrubs. Who the hell could it be? She was already on call. Her secretary knew she was assisting at a birth.
"Will you excuse me?" she said, leaving the labor nurse in the room to fill in while she walked to the nurse's desk and borrowed a telephone. "What's going on?" Lacey asked when her secretary picked up. "One of your patients insisting to see you."
"I'm a little busy," Lacey said pointedly.
"She said she'll wait, for however long it takes."
"Who is it?"
"Alex Cormier," the secretary replied.
Normally, Lacey would have told her secretary to have the patient see one of the other midwives in the practice, but there was still something elusive about Alex Cormier, something she couldn't put her finger on, something that wasn't quite right.
"All right," Lacey said, "but tell her it might be hours."
She hung up the phone and hurried back into the birthing room, where she reached between the patient's legs to check her dilation.
"Apparently all you needed was for me to leave," she joked.
"You're 10 centimeters. The next time you feel like pushing, go to town."
10 minutes later, Lacey delivered a 3-pound baby girl. As the parents marveled over her, Lacey turned to the labor nurse, silently communicating with her eyes. Something had gone terribly wrong.
"She's so tiny," the father said. Is she okay?
Lacey hesitated, because she didn't really know the answer. A fibroid? She wondered. All she knew for certain was that there was a lot more inside that woman than a 3-pound infant, and that any moment now, her patient was going to start to bleed. But when Lacey reached up to grab the patient's belly and press down on her uterus, she froze.
Did anyone tell you you were having twins?
The father went ashen.
There's two in there?
Lacey grinned. Twins she could handle. Twins? Well, that was a bonus, not some horrible medical disaster.
Well, only one now.
The man crouched down beside his wife and kissed her forehead, delighted.
Did you hear that, Terry? Twins!
His wife didn't take her eyes off her tiny newborn daughter.
That's nice, she said calmly, but I'm not pushing a second one out.
Lacey laughed.
Oh, I think I might be able to get you to change your mind.
40 minutes later, Lacey left the happy family with their twin daughters and headed down the hallway to the staff restroom, where she splashed water on her face and changed into a fresh pair of scrubs. She took the stairs up to the midwifery office and glanced at the collection of women, sitting with their arms balanced on bellies of all sizes, like moons in different stages. One rose, red-eyed and unsteady, as if she'd been pulled upright magnetically by Lacey's arrival.
Alex,
she said, remembering only in that instant that she had another patient waiting.
Why don't you come with me?
She led Alex into an empty examination room and sat down across from her in a chair. At that moment, Lacey noticed that Alex's sweater was on backward. It was a pale blue crew neck. You could barely even tell, except that the tag had flapped out along the curve of her neck. And it was certainly something that might happen to anyone in a rush, anyone upset. But probably not Alex Cormier.
There's been bleeding, Alex said, her voice even. Not a lot, but, some.
Taking a cue from Alex herself, Lacey kept her own response calm.
Why don't we check anyway?
Lacey led Alex down the hallway to fetal ultrasound. She charmed a tech into letting them cut the patient line, and once she had Alex lying down on the table, she turned on the machine. She moved the transducer across Alex's abdomen. At 16 weeks, the fetus looked like a baby. Tiny, skeletal, but startlingly perfect.
Do you see that?
Lacey asked, pointing to a blinking cursor, a tiny black-and-white drum beat.
That's the baby's heart.
Alex turned her face away, but not before Lacey saw a tear streak down her cheek.
The baby's fine,
she said, and it's perfectly normal to have some staining or spotting. It's not anything you did that caused it. There's nothing you can do to make it stop.
I thought I was having a miscarriage.
Once you see a normal baby, like we just did, the chance of miscarrying is less than 1%. Let me put that another way. Your chance of carrying a normal baby to term is 99%. Alex nodded, wiping at her eyes with her sleeve.
Good.
Lacey hesitated. It's not my place to say this, really, but for someone who doesn't want this baby, Alex, you seem awfully relieved to know she's all right.
I can't.
Lacey glanced at the ultrasound screen, where Alex's baby was frozen in a moment of time.
Just think about it, she said.
I already have a family, Logan Rourke said later that day when Alex told him she planned to keep the baby.
I don't need another one.
That night, Alex had an exorcism of sorts. She filled up her Weber grill with charcoal and lit a fire, then roasted every assignment she had turned in to Logan Rourke. She had no photos of the two of them, no sweet notes. In retrospect, she realized how careful he'd been, how easily he could be erased from her life. This baby,
she decided, would be hers alone. She sat, watching the flames, and thought of the space it would take up inside her. She imagined her organs moving aside, skin stretching. She pictured her heart shrinking, tiny as a beach stone, to make room. She didn't consider whether she was having this baby to prove that she hadn't imagined her relationship with Logan Rourke, or to upset him as much as he had upset her. As any skilled trial attorney knows, you never ask the witness a question to which you do not know the answer. 5 weeks later, Lacey was no longer just Alex's midwife. She was also her confidant, her best friend, her sounding board. Although Lacey didn't normally socialize with her clients, for Alex, she'd broken the rules. She told herself it was because Alex, who had now decided to keep this baby, really needed a support system, and there wasn't anyone else she felt comfortable with. It was the only reason, Lacey decided, she had agreed to go out with Alex's colleagues this evening. Even the prospect of a girls' night out, without babies, lost its luster in this company. Lacey should have realized 2 back-to-back root canals would have been preferable to dinner with a bunch of lawyers. They all liked to hear themselves talk, that was clear. She let the conversation flow around her, as if she were a stone in a river, and she kept refilling her wine glass with Coke from a pitcher. The restaurant was some Italian place with very bad red sauce and a chef who went heavy on the garlic. She wondered if, in Italy, there were American restaurants. Alex was in the middle of a heated discussion about some trial that had gone to jury. Lacey heard terms being tossed and fielded around the table. FLSA, Singh versus Jutla, incentives. A florid woman sitting to Lacey's right shook her head. "It's sending a message," she said. "If you award damages for work that's illegal, you're sanctioning a company to be above the law." Alex laughed. "Sita, I'm just going to take this moment to remind you that you're the only prosecutor at the table, and there's no way in hell you're going to win this one." "We're all biased. We need an objective observer." Sita smiled at Lacey. "What's your opinion on aliens?" Maybe she should have paid more attention to the conversation. Apparently it had taken a turn for the interesting while Lacey was wool-gathering. "Well, I'm certainly not an expert, but I did finish a book a little while ago about Area 51 and the cover-up by the government. It went into specific detail about cattle mutilation. I find it very suspicious when a cow in Nevada winds up missing its kidneys, and the incision doesn't show any trauma to tissue or blood loss. I had a cat once that I think was abducted by aliens. She went missing for exactly 4 weeks to the minute, and when she came back, she had triangle patterns burned out on the fur on her back, sort of like a crop circle." Lacey hesitated. "But without the wheat." Everyone at the table stared at her, silent. A woman with a pinhole of a mouth and a sleek blonde bob blinked at Lacey.
"We were talking about illegal aliens."
Lacey felt heat creep up her neck.
"Oh," she said. "Right." "Well, if you ask me," Alex said, drawing attention in her own direction, "Lacey ought to be heading up the Department of Labor instead of Aline Chow. She's certainly got more experience." Everyone broke up in laughter as Lacey watched. Alex, she realized, could fit anywhere. Here, or with Lacey's family at dinner, or in a courtroom, or probably at tea with the Queen. She was a chameleon. It struck Lacey that she didn't really know what color a chameleon was before it started changing. There was a moment at each prenatal exam when Lacey channeled her inner faith healer, laying her hands on the patient's belly and divining, just from the lay of the land, in which direction the baby lay. It always reminded her of those Halloween fun houses she took Joey to visit. You'd stick your hand behind a curtain and feel a bowl of cold spaghetti intestines or a gelatin brain. It wasn't an exact science, but basically,
There were two hard parts on a fetus, the head and the bottom. If you rocked the baby's head, it would twist on the stem of its spine. If you rocked the baby's bottom, it swayed. Moving the head moved only the head. Moving the bottom moved the whole baby. She let her hands trail over the island of Alex's belly and helped her sit up. "The good news is that the baby's doing fine," Lacey said. "The bad news is that right now she's upside down. Breech." Alex froze.
"I'm going to need a C-section?"
"We've got 8 weeks before it comes to that. There's a lot we can do to try to turn the baby beforehand."
"Like what?"
"Moxibustion." She sat across from Lacey. "I'll give you the name of an acupuncturist. She'll take a little stick of mugwort and hold it up to your little pinky. She'll do the same thing on the other side. It won't hurt, but it'll be uncomfortably warm. Once you learn how to do it at home, if you start now, chances are fairly good that the baby will turn in 1 to 2 weeks' time." "Poking myself with a stick is going to make it flip?" "Well, not necessarily. That's why I also want you to set an ironing board up against the couch to make an inclined plane. You should lie on it, head down, 3 times a day for 15 minutes.
"Geez, Lacey, are you sure you don't want me to wear a crystal, too?"
"Believe me, any of those are considerably more comfortable than having a doctor do a version to turn the baby, or recuperating from a C-section." Alex folded her hands over her belly.
"I don't hold much faith in old wives' tales."
Lacey shrugged. "Luckily, you're not the one who's breech." You weren't supposed to give your clients rides to court, but in Nadia Saranoff's case, Alex made an exception. Nadia's husband had been abusive and had left her for another woman. He wouldn't pay child support for their 2 boys, although he was making a decent living, and Nadia's job at Subway paid $5.25 an hour. She'd complained to the state, but justice worked too slow, so she'd gone to Walmart and shoplifted a pair of pants and a white shirt for her 5-year-old, who was starting school the following week and who had outgrown all of his clothing. Nadia had pled guilty. Because she couldn't afford a fine, she was given a 30-day jail sentence deferred, which, as Alex was explaining to her now, meant that she wouldn't have to go for a year. "If you go to jail," she said, as they stood outside the ladies' room in the courthouse, "your boys are going to suffer greatly. I know you feel desperate, but there's always another option, a church or a Salvation Army." Nadia wiped her eyes.
"I couldn't get to the church or the Salvation Army. I haven't got a car."
Right. It was why Alex had brought her to court in the first place. Alex steeled herself against sympathy as Nadia ducked into the bathroom. Her job had been to get Nadia a good deal, which she had, considering this was the woman's second shoplifting offense. The first one had been at a drugstore. She'd pinched some children's Tylenol. She thought of her own baby, the one who had her lying upside down on an ironing board and sticking torturous little daggers against her pinky toes every night in the hopes that it would change position. What sort of disadvantage would it be to come into this world backward? When 10 minutes had passed and Nadia had not come out of the bathroom, Alex knocked on the door.
"Nadia?"
She found her client in front of the sinks, sobbing.
"Nadia, what's wrong?"
Her client ducked her head, mortified.
"I just got my period, and I can't afford a tampon."
Alex reached for her purse, rummaging for a quarter to feed to the dispenser on the wall. But as the cardboard tube rolled out of the machine, something inside her snapped, and she understood that although this case had been settled, it wasn't over yet.
"Meet me out front," she ordered. "I'm getting the car."
She drove Nadia to Walmart, the scene of her crime, and tossed 3 supersized Tampax boxes into a cart.
"What else do you need?" "Underwear, Nadia whispered.
That was my last pair.
Alex wheeled up and down the aisles, buying t-shirts and socks and panties and pajamas for Nadia, pants and coats and hats and gloves for her boys, boxes of goldfish crackers and saltines and canned soup and pasta and devil dogs. Desperate, she did what she had to do at that moment, although it was exactly what the public defender's office counseled their lawyers not to. But she was entirely rational and aware that she had never done this for a client and never would do it again. She spent $800 in the very store that had pressed charges against Nadia, because it was easier to fix what was wrong than to picture her own child arriving into a world Alex herself could sometimes not stomach. The catharsis ended the moment Alex handed the cashier her credit card and heard Logan Rourke's voice in her mind. "Bleeding heart," he'd called her. Well, he should know. He'd been the first to rip it to pieces.
"All right," Alex thought calmly. "This is what it's like to die."
Another contraction ripped through her, bullets strafing metal. 2 weeks ago, at her 37-week visit, Alex and Lacey had talked about pain medication.
"What are your feelings about it?"
Lacey had asked, and Alex had made a joke.
"I think it should be imported from Canada."
She had told Lacey she didn't plan to use pain medication, that she wanted a natural childbirth, that it couldn't possibly hurt that much. It did. She thought back to all those birthing classes Lacey had forced her to take. The ones where she'd been partnered with Lacey, because everyone else had a husband or boyfriend assisting them. They'd shown pictures of women in labor, women with their rubbery faces and gritted teeth, women making prehistoric noises. Alex had scoffed at this.
"They are showing the worst-case scenarios," she'd told herself. "Different people have different tolerance for pain."
The next contraction twisted down her spine like a cobra, wrapped itself around her belly, and sank its fangs. Alex fell hard on her knees on the kitchen floor. In her classes, she'd learned that pre-labor could go on for 12 hours or more. By then, if she wasn't dead, she'd shoot herself. When Lacey had been a midwife in training, she'd spent months walking around with a little centimeter ruler, measuring. Now, after years on the job, she could eyeball a coffee cup and know that it was 9 centimeters across, that the orange beside the phone at the nurse's station was an 8. She withdrew her fingers from between Alex's legs and snapped off the latex glove.
"You're 2 centimeters, she said.
And Alex burst into tears.
"Only 2? I can't do this," Alex panted, twisting her spine to get away from the pain.
She had tried to hide the discomfort behind the mask of competence that she usually wore, only to realize that in her hurry, she must have left it behind somewhere.
"I know you're disappointed," Lacey said, "but here's the thing. You're doing fine. We know that when people are fine at 2 centimeters, they will be fine at 8, too. Let's take it 1 contraction at a time."
Labor was hard for everyone, Lacey knew, but especially hard for the women who had expectations and lists and plans, because it was never the way you thought it would be. In order to labor well, you had to let your body take over instead of your mind. You revealed yourself, even the parts you had forgotten about. For someone like Alex, who was so used to being in control, this could be devastating. Success would come only at the expense of losing her cool, at the risk of turning into someone she didn't want to be. Lacey helped Alex off the bed and guided her toward the whirlpool room. She dimmed the lights, flicked on the instrumental music, and untied Alex's robe. Alex was past the point of modesty. At this moment, Lacey figured, she'd disrobe in front of an entire male prison population if it meant the contractions would stop.
In you go, Lacey said, letting Alex lean on her as she sank into the whirlpool. There was a Pavlovian response to warm water. Sometimes just stepping into the tub could bring down a person's heart rate.
Lacey, Alex gasped, you have to promise.
Promise what?
You won't tell her. The baby.
Lacey reached for Alex's hand.
Tell her what?
Alex closed her eyes and pressed her cheek against the lip of the tub.
That at first I didn't want her.
Before she could even answer, Lacey watched tension grip Alex.
Breathe through this one, she said. Blow the pain away from you. Blow it between your hands. Picture it as the color red. Come up on your hands and knees. Pour yourself inward, like sand in an hourglass. Go to the beach, Alex. Lie on the sand and see how warm the sun is. Lie to yourself until it's true.
When you're hurting deeply, you go inward. Lacey had seen this 1,000 times. Endorphins kick in, the body's natural morphine, and carry you somewhere far away, where the pain can't find you. Once, a client who'd been abused had dissociated so massively that Lacey was worried she wouldn't be able to reach her again and bring her back in time to push. She had wound up singing to the woman in Spanish, a lullaby. For 3 hours now, Alex had regained her composure, thanks to the anesthesiologist who'd given her an epidural. She'd slept for a while. She'd played hearts with Lacey. But now the baby had dropped, and she was starting to bear down.
Why is it hurting again? She asked, her voice escalating. That's how an epidural works. If we dose it up, you can't push. I can't have a baby, Alex blurted out. I'm not ready.
Well, Lacey said, maybe we ought to talk about that.
What was I thinking? Logan was right. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm not a mother. I'm a lawyer. I don't have a boyfriend. I don't have a dog. I don't even have a houseplant I haven't killed. I'm not even sure how to put on a diaper.
The little cartoon characters go on the front, Lacey said. She took Alex's hand and brought it down between her legs to where the baby was crowning. Alex jerked her hand away.
Is that...
Yeah.
It's coming?
Ready or not? Another contraction started.
Oh, Alex, I can see the eyebrows.
Lacey eased the baby out of the birth canal, keeping the head flexed.
I know how much it burns. There's her chin. Beautiful.
Lacey wiped off the baby's face, suctioned the mouth. She flipped the cord over the baby's neck and looked up at her friend.
Alex, she said, let's do this together.
Lacey guided Alex's shaking hands to cup the infant's head.
Stay like that. I'm going to push down to get the shoulder.
As the baby sluiced into Alex's hands, Lacey let go. Sobbing, relieved, Alex brought the small, squirming body against her chest. As always, Lacey was taken by how available a newborn is, how present. She rubbed the small of the baby's back and watched the newborn's hazy blue eyes focus first on her mother.
Alex, Lacey said, she's all yours. To anyone who cares. Nobody wants to admit this, but bad things will keep on happening. Maybe that's because it's all a chain, and a long time ago, someone did the first bad thing, and that led someone else to do another bad thing, and so on. You know, like that game where you whisper a sentence into someone's ear, and that person whispers it to someone else, and it all comes out wrong in the end. But then again, maybe bad things happen because it's the only way we can keep remembering what good is supposed to look like. Hours after. Once, at a bar,
Patrick's best friend, Nina, had asked what the worst thing he'd ever seen was. He'd answered truthfully, back when he was in Maine, and a guy had committed suicide by tying himself with wire to the train tracks. The train had literally cleaved him in two. There had been blood and body parts everywhere. Seasoned officers reached the crime scene and started throwing up in the scrub brush. Patrick had walked away to gain his composure and found himself staring down at the man's severed head, the mouth still round with a silent scream. That was no longer the worst thing Patrick had ever seen. There were still students streaming out of Sterling High as teams of EMTs began canvassing the building to take care of the wounded. Dozens of kids had minor cuts and bruises from the mass exodus, scores were hyperventilating or hysterical, and even more were in shock. But Patrick's first priority was taking care of the shooting victims, who lay sprawled on the floor from the cafeteria to the gymnasium, a bloody trail that chronicled the shooter's movements. The fire alarms were still ringing, and the safety sprinklers had created a running river in the hallway. Beneath the spray, two EMTs bent over a girl who'd been shot in the right shoulder. "Let's get her on a sled," the medic said. Patrick knew her, he realized, and a shudder went through his body. She worked at the video store in town. Last weekend, when he'd rented Dirty Harry, she'd told him that he still had a late charge of $3.40. He saw her every Friday night when he rented a DVD, but he'd never asked her name. Why the hell hadn't he asked? As the girl whimpered, the medic took the Sharpie marker he was holding and wrote 9 on her forehead.
"We don't have IDs on all of the wounded," he told Patrick, "so we've started numbering them."
As the student was shifted onto a backboard, Patrick reached across her for a yellow plastic shock blanket, one every officer carried in the back of his cruiser. He ripped it into quarters, glanced at the number on the girl's forehead, and wrote a matching 9 on one of the squares.
"Leave this in her place," he instructed. "That way we can figure out who she is later and where she was found."
An EMT stuck his head around the corner. "Hitchcock says all the beds are taken. We've got kids lined up on the front lawn waiting, but the ambulances have nowhere to go."
"What about APD?
"They're full, too."
"Then call Concord and tell them we've got buses coming in," Patrick ordered.
From the corner of his eye, he saw an EMT, he knew, an old-timer planning to retire in 3 months, walk away from a body and sink into a crouch, sobbing. Patrick grabbed the sleeve of a passing officer.
"Jarvis, I need your help."
"But you just assigned me to the gym, Captain."
Patrick had divided up the responding officers and the major crimes unit of the state police so that each part of the high school had its own team of first responders. Now, he handed Jarvis the remaining pieces of the plastic shock blanket and a black marker.
"Forget the gym. I want you to do a circuit of the whole school and check in with the EMTs. Anyone who's numbered gets a numbered blanket left in place when they're transported."
"I have one bleeding out in the girls' room," a voice called.
"I'm on it,"
an EMT said, picking up a bag of supplies and hurrying away.
"Make sure you haven't forgotten anything," Patrick told himself. "You only get to do this once."
His head felt like it was made of glass, too heavy and too thin-walled to handle the weight of so much information. He couldn't be everywhere at once. He couldn't talk fast enough or think quickly enough to dispatch his men where they needed to be. He had no fucking idea how to process a nightmare this massive, and yet he had to pretend that he did, because everyone else was looking to him to be in charge. The double doors of the cafeteria swung shut behind him. By now, the team working this room had assessed and transported the injured. Only the bodies remained behind. The cinderblock walls were chipped where bullets had pierced or grazed them. A vending machine, glass shattered, bottles pierced,
dribbled Sprite and Coke and Dasani onto the linoleum floor. One of the crime techs was photographing evidence.